Rock musician Jack White lived in Detroit until 10 years ago when he moved to Nashville, but his profile back in his hometown is going back up this Friday when he opens his new record store, Third Man Records, in the Cass Corridor in Detroit, 441 Canfield Street. The store will include 4,000 square feet of retail space and a record pressing plant. It'll be one of only around 20 left in the entire country. Vinyl refuses to die. Also, the Detroit News reports that the store is just a stone's throw from where the White Stripes played their first concert. The venue was called the Gold Dollar. That was in August of 97. The club is no longer there. Welcome back to Current State here on the day before Thanksgiving. Delighted that you could join us here today. I'm Mark Bayshore. The city of Flint is fighting for its survival. It is contending with lead-contaminated water that sickened a number of residents and generated legal action. Flint has seen steady population decline for decades, which erodes tax revenues and support services. And though the city is no longer under the direction of an emergency manager, it's still under state oversight. Into this landscape, enter Karen Williams Weaver. Flint's first female mayor was sworn into office on November 9th. She's working with an array of local, state, and federal officials to restore safe drinking water. And in the coming days, she plans to unveil a strategy for her first 100 days in office. I spoke with Mayor Weaver yesterday and first asked her about the ongoing water crisis and what she believes must happen to resolve it.
One of the things I want to look at is having Flint declared a disaster area. That's what we have to have happen, because that's how we're going to be able to get the finances, the funds that we need to fix this problem. Because if you look at it, it's a public health crisis and it's an infrastructure crisis for us. So we've got to address those two things, but we've really got to do something to ensure the safety of the public. That's top of the list.
Is your call to issue a disaster area designation, is that falling on deaf ears, or are you getting the attention of state officials? Or
well, you know what, and that's what, because I know I'm not the one to make the call, and so I am, got to work with State Senator Ananick and the state representatives, Neely and Phelps, and have Congressman Kildee. We've all got to be on the same page and at the table so we can, we need to push the governor to do this, because that's where the call comes from. It's from the governor's office. And so we've been in conversation. So that's what I would love to have happen, because like I said, we need more money than the city has. It's more money than the state has, and we need some federal assistance.
People in Flint are now looking to you for leadership on this front. How are you communicating with your constituents about the water situation? What's that dialogue like?
One of the things that I've been doing, I have been on TV and on radio programs talking, but one of the things I committed to do, and the first one will start next month, is monthly town hall meetings. For the first year, I said, I've got to have monthly town hall meetings because I want to be able to communicate with them directly and let them hear what it is we're doing, how we're doing it, and get feedback from them. So we do have one that will be taking place in December. And like I said, that will be monthly. There's also something I've been, Channel 5 does something every week that's called Ask the Mayor, where we can get information out there. I'll be also working with the newspaper and MLive. So we're doing things to get the message out. And also, when we have some of the meetings, the task force meetings, those are open meetings to the public. So we're trying, whatever we have to do to get the word out is what we'll do.
This is a pretty significant challenge, as I think everyone would agree. Do you feel like you have to prove yourself to the people who voted for you here? Do you feel like maybe you've got a honeymoon period here right now, but you've got to make some things happen in pretty short order?
Well, I guess there's always a honeymoon period, but not when you have the water crisis that we have.
Precisely.
So some things do need to happen, and some things need to happen quickly. And so that's why I said, you know what, we need to at least get started with these meetings and let people know what's going on, because that was the issue, was even though we were in this crisis, people felt like information wasn't being shared with them or misinformation was being shared. And one of the things that I told them was, whether it was good news or bad news, I'm going to share the information because the citizens of the community deserve to know what's going on, good, bad, or indifferent. They deserve to know. And so that's one of the things that I will be starting immediately, because we've experienced broken trust. And so we've got to build the trust back up, you know, build the trust of the community back up. And so that's why I'm really looking forward to these meetings and these different things we're putting in place so the public can be informed. So we're starting there. We're also doing, we're going to be doing a search for a director of our DPW, our Department of Public Works, because, you know, we've made some changes there. So we've got to get somebody in that is really, really able to meet those qualifications and do the job that needs to be done.
We're talking with the new mayor of Flint, Dr. Karen Williams-Weaver. She's a licensed clinical psychologist by trade, but now she is the first female mayor in Flint's history. She took office back on November 9th. About 2 weeks ago, several Flint families filed a federal lawsuit. It accuses 14 officials of causing a host of health problems. They say they contracted after the city switched to Flint River water, and the suit says that these officials, which include former emergency manager Darnell Early, did this to cut costs and failed to do anything to treat the water. I want to get your response to the lawsuit. Do you feel it's justified, and do you hope that the lawsuit is successful?
Well, you know, I can't talk about the lawsuit. I'm not surprised that it has happened, though. You know, that was one of the things that we knew, even while I was campaigning, we knew that lawsuits would be coming, you know, as a result of this. So really, what I have to do is see what we, and not with, I'm not speaking to this particular lawsuit. We had one that was filed as far as the water rates and some things that needed to have happened that people said, well, if this goes through, the city will be bankrupt. And so what I need to do is really sit down and work with the attorney and see what we can negotiate that's in the best interest of the city, because we know the people are owed something, and we know we don't want to bankrupt the city as well. And so really, it's time for us to sit and negotiate and see what we can do that's in the best interest of everybody here, because we do have to protect the public, but we also have to protect the city. So I think it's time for us to come to the table and see what we can work out.
Talk to us about how you're utilizing any local resources in Flint. I mean, I know the Mott Foundation, based in Flint, has contributed $4 million to reconnect the city with the Carrigandee mm-hmm. Water Authority.
There are a lot of ways. That's true, and there are a lot of ways. Because one of the things, and I'm glad you said that, because we've got some really great resources here in the city of Flint, especially when you look at the colleges and universities and the hospitals. You see how they came together really get this going to help us get back to Detroit water when the medical community spoke up. And that was a partnership. That was with Hurley Hospital, the health department, Hamilton Health, Mott Children's Health Center, and the Health Coalition. And so they were able to leverage all those resources and say, look, we need to go back to Detroit water. We also have Kettering University, U of M Flint, Mott Community College. We have some of the, even though I'm a Spartan, go green, but we've got some of the best universities here, and they can help us as well as far as when we're looking at how do we do testing. We've got engineers over at Kettering University that can be helpful to us. So we're looking at what are all of the resources we have in the city of Flint, and we know we don't have all of them, but we can bring some parts to the table to help us look at what are we doing, how are we going to move forward, and they can be part of that. So I'm really excited. I'm really excited about that. And they're at the table, and we're talking about what are some things you all can do to help us, even if it's with right now what I said is a Band-Aid fix with the filters. We have some people that don't know how to put them on. We have some people where they need a different ones. They can't get out. So can we have even students help us go to these people's houses, help these seniors get them on their, you know, faucets so they work? If they're homebound, okay, we need X number delivered. But we, you know, we're looking at what can we do to be helpful to everybody that's here, and what can we do ourselves.
We're talking with Flint Mayor Karen Weaver. You've said that reestablishing home rule for the city is a key priority for your administration. What will it take to achieve that?
Well, I'm hoping I'm in conversation with the state. about that, because that's what we want to have happen. That's what we should have happen. Right now, you know, we're in violation of the charter, and our charter is a strong mayor form of government.
Well, the city is no longer under the daily control of an emergency manager, but I understand you still have in place what's called the RTAB, the Receivership Transition
Exactly.
Advisory Board. What's your relationship like with that board? What is their responsibility?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've told everybody, and it hasn't changed, is, I want a relationship with them. I've only been here 2 weeks, so it's not like I have, you know, everything has happened yet. But one of the things we have to do is look at what's best for the city and try to move things forward. And I would hope that we have goals bigger than ourselves that we can say, yes, here are the things that need to be in place. Here are the things that we have to do. Because the people spoke out loud and clear. They're looking for change. They don't want just a new face with the same old thing, because that's not change. The people need to be listened to. So I hope that came through loud and clearly, and we'll find out.
You hear a lot about unfunded liabilities that confront a lot of cities, quite a few of them here in Michigan. Talk to us about the numbers there. What is Flint's fiscal condition right now? What are you facing in terms of unfunded liabilities in the future?
Well, you know, it depends on what happens. And that's why I was saying we've got to sit down at the table and negotiate some of these issues with lawsuits, because we want to be fiscally responsible. We've got to do some things. We don't want to go back into receivership. So it's time for us to come to the table and say, okay, what can we do that's in the best interest of everybody? So because that helps keep us as far as local control. We've got to do these things. But if these lawsuits aren't worked out in a way that makes sense, that could be a problem for Flint, and we know that, and we don't want that to happen. And so one of the things I want to do is be proactive and sit down with the attorney and say, okay, let's start negotiating right now. What can we do? Because that could be a problem. You're absolutely right.
We've all seen Detroit emerge from bankruptcy, and there is hope for the city of Detroit that just was nowhere to be found a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get on that upward trajectory, short of declaring bankruptcy? Nobody wants to declare bankruptcy, but, I mean, the people do say Detroit was able to turn around because they declared
right.
bankruptcy.
And I believe that Flint can as well. I believe Flint can as well, but we have to be able to take care of ourselves, and we need to have control so we can make some of the decisions. When other people are making decisions for you, that's very difficult. So I think that's some of what needs to happen. Like I said, we've got to negotiate some things, but I think we can do it, just like Detroit has been able to do it. I think Flint can do it as well. And I had to think it, or I wouldn't have, you know, run for this office,
mm-hmm.
because I believe it can happen.
Flint has seen enormous population loss, really spanning several decades.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts in terms of retaining citizens and businesses that you still have?
And that's what we have to do. There's some housekeeping we have to do here in the city, and one is addressing the water issue, because that will make people leave. We've got to address our public safety issue. So we've got to do some neighborhood rehabilitation, stabilization, because and we've got to be more small business friendly. There's some things that we can put in place, because we need to keep who's here, and we want to attract other people to come here. But there's some things that we can do that we have to do to show that we can take care of our own house, and I think that will help, because you know when you take care of those things, when people start seeing that we've put some things in place. It helps our schools, too. And one of the things that's nice is that Ruth Mott just made a huge commitment to the north side of Flint to help as far as putting some public safety, addressing some of those issues, giving money for community policing, and for us to be able to do some things on that side, because the north side and the east side of Flint are two of the most neglected areas in the city. And so having Ruth Mott come in and help with that gives us some leverage that maybe we can get some other players to come to the table and help us with that as well. So we do have some, you know, that's one of the good things going on in Flint. We do have some other things. I believe we need to promote ourselves better, because if you're looking to start businesses here, you know, if we take care of those things I talked about, we have, you know, if you need shipping or freight, we've got Bishop Airport, we've got two major railways, we've got the expressways, we've got the hospitals, the universities, we've got a lot of industrial land available. So we have some things to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was saying, if we can take care of some of those other housekeeping issues, that's only going to help us. And that, you know, and I'm hoping that will help us stop this spiraling down, because we need to keep people here and we need to bring new people here.
We have been talking with Flint Mayor, Dr. Karen Williams Weaver. She is the first female mayor in the city's history. Dr. Weaver, best of luck. Thanks for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And coming up on Current State, for a few years now, we've asked MSU corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski to spice up our Thanksgiving table with a new recipe. Kurt whipped up a dressing that will go nicely with your turkey.
I like sausage in my stuffing, so we've got some sweet Italian sausage and then some fresh herbs.
Scott Pohl has Kurt's recipe later this hour, plus one of the markers of adulthood is being able to budget and handle your own finances. And Junior Achievement of Mid-Michigan is giving Lansing area kids a head start. We hear more in our weekly Neighbors in Action segment. That and more coming up on Current State. For now, calling all cat lovers, Michigan's first cat cafe has opened its doors. The Ferndale Cat Shelter's new storefront lets you snuggle up to some feline friends while enjoying a cup of coffee and tea. The Cat Fay Lounge opened its doors just a few weeks ago, and to tell us how it's been going is the shelter's volunteer coordinator, Deanne Iovan. Hi, Deanne.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. Where did this idea come from?
Well, you know, the Cat Cafe idea has been popular in Japan for many years. It started in, I believe, in Korea, in South Korea, and you know, the idea was there were people that couldn't have pets, so they would go to this cafe and they would get a coffee and they would snuggle with an animal, preferably a cat, and get their little kitty fix for the day and then go home. but for us, you know, we don't have a proper cafe at this time, but I had a story about a shelter in California that opened one of their adoption rooms and turned it into what they called a cafe. So they had self-serve coffee. And so that was our approach to kind of, because we don't have the money to build out the cafe yet, but we wanted the cats to get visibility to the public as soon as possible, that we decided to do this first phase, which is the cafe lounge. So it's self-serve coffee and tea. We have bottled water and juice. We have a local caterer who's going to be making vegan kosher cookies for us called Nosh Pit, which is going to be great. It's been really exciting. We've already adopted out about 12 cats.
You've adopted out 12 already. You've been open long?
For just under 3 weeks.
Well, you're at the cutting edge of a new trend here. You offer tea and coffee, but you've also been planning some cat themed activities for the community in the cafe. Tell us about those.
Yes. Well, actually, I like to say it's because I need to do yoga and I don't have time to do it. So I planned a cat yoga class here. So we have a really great yoga instructor named Carla. She's doing our Friday morning yoga class with the cats. And then we have a woman named Miranda who's doing a Pilates class on Saturday morning. So Pilates with cats. It's going to be great. And I also like to get a cat meditation class in here, because I think that would be a really appropriate activity to do with cats.
Well, you got your upward cat and your downward cat there.
Right.
Is that right? Where do the cats at the cafe come from, and how long do they stay there typically?
So the cats stay here until they're adopted. They come from our foster homes. Ferndale Cat Shelter has a long list of foster homes, private homes, where people take care of these kitties for us. So these cats are either rescued off the street, they are abandoned by people when they move, they're surrendered by people because their circumstances change and they can no longer care for them. And, you know, of course, then there's, in the springtime, there's the pregnant cats, you know, that have the litters of kittens. So So yeah, they come from all different places, and as we have room in the cafe, we bring them in as we adopt more cats out.
It's always floored me that there are people who just abandon their pets when they move. That is almost, I don't know, I was stunned the first time that I heard that that was actually a common thing. That is a common theme in as far as the cats that you come into at the shelter?
Well, you know, Ferndale, it has a large rental population, and so did the surrounding communities like Oak Park and Hazel Park and Royal Oak, and so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of transients in our cities. So yeah, people move and they leave their animal because they can't afford them anymore, or they can't take, you know, them to their new place. And I think there's this misconception. I know there is this misconception that cats can take care of themselves out on the street, which is really kind of ridiculous, because if you feed a cat every day and clean out its litter box and, you know, talk in a nice baby voice to it, the cat thinks it's a child for its entire life. It never really learns how to become an adult. Mm. Its brain doesn't really develop the skills that adult cats need to survive outside. So when you abandon a cat outside, you're really, you know, it's really a death sentence for them, because, you know, not only is there starvation, you know, impending starvation, but you know, there's cars and diseases from other animals, and it's not a good idea, but it happens all the time. So we're just here to help educate the community about that as much as possible, and help people take care of community cats as well. So the feral cat population that does know how to survive outside, help them take care of them as well as they can.
Deanne Iovan is the volunteer coordinator for the Ferndale Cat Shelter. We're talking about the shelter's recent launch of Michigan's first cat cafe, or cat fay, if you will. I imagine that for people who love cats, getting to enjoy a warm drink in a room full of them is a lot of fun, but there's obviously a benefit for the... Is there a benefit for the cats living at the cafe?
Oh, absolutely. The cats get so much exercise, playtime, socialization with a variety of people, young and old, and so that's really great. But, you know, it's a really great benefit for us to pet a cat. Just that action of petting their soft fur and interacting with them in a very gentle way is just a really therapeutic thing for us as humans to do. So it's mutually beneficial.
Have you given any thought on what you'd like to see for the future of the Cat Cafe? Are you going to build this thing out and offer food, or what?
Yeah, well, that's the goal. We're giving this phase of the project about 6 months to see how well it's received in the community, to see, you know, if this is something that Ferndale wants, that people in the surrounding community want, and if we can get some more financial support. What we're really looking for is some private donors, some corporate donors to build out a proper cafe that will help us become a sustainable cat rescue. So we don't have to keep begging people for money. We'll be able to use profits from the cafe to finance our programs.
What kind of response have you gotten from people stopping by so far?
It's been amazing. I mean, you know, my husband says that he spends far too much time in here instead of being at work. But he said he said every time he's here that everyone that comes in has a smile on their face. Everyone's so happy to be here, and it's the response has been great. People love it, and I think the community really does support it and needs it. And so I just hope that this isn't because we're new, that we're busy. I hope that this continues to get visited by many people from around the state.
We've been talking about Michigan's first Cat Cafe with Deanne Iovan, volunteer coordinator for the Ferndale Cat Shelter, which owns the Cat Fay Lounge. Good luck, Deanne.
Thank you so much.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving to you too.
And coming up on Current State, one of the best ways to prepare kids for adulthood is to educate them about finances. We'll hear how Junior Achievement of Mid-Michigan is working to do just that on Neighbors in Action. Plus, there's still time to consider a new recipe for the dressing you'll serve with your turkey tomorrow. Coming up, Chef Kurt Kwiatkowski shows us a family favorite that includes Italian sausage. Yum. Stay with us. Well, I know I speak for everyone here on the Current State staff when I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. We're heading into a kind of a goofy four-day period, but it's a time of year a lot of people love. It's a time for us here at WKAR to always give thanks for our generous Sound Vision Society members. We have lots to be thankful for here. Legacy Circle members, corporate underwriters, volunteers, and TV and radio financial contributors are at the top of our list. You all make public media possible. We are grateful you've chosen WKAR for a philanthropic gift. Thank you for being a part of the WKAR family. You play an important role here. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR. There are lots of components to a well-rounded education, and one that can get overlooked is the very practical area of financial skills. For Current State's Neighbors in Action segment this week, we're taking a look at an organization that strives to empower young people with those skills, Junior Achievement of Mid-Michigan. Mid-Michigan. The volunteer-based organization promotes economic success in young people by teaching financial literacy, entrepreneurship, and work readiness to K-12 students in Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. Joining us today in the studio are Junior Achievement of Mid-Michigan's Senior Program Manager, Chris Hakor. Welcome, Chris. And volunteer Sujatha Shankar. Welcome, Sujatha.
Thank you, Mark.
Chris, do the kids come to you for the classes? Do you go to them? How do you connect?
Actually, what we do is we basically reach out to the teachers and principals and superintendents, and we meet with them, and the teachers actually send me a program request form. And what we do is from there, we tell them, they tell us what the program is that they would like, and we go ahead and set them up with that.
Does the school system typically put this out there for the kids, or is this a decision that the administrators make?
This is a decision basically that the principal and the teachers make.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not out there just for the kids.
About how many schools are you working with here in the Tri-County area?
Right now, we probably have over, I'm going to say, 30 schools that we work with.
And how many volunteers do you have?
You know what? We have over 240 volunteers that we use on a yearly basis, and that encompasses both fall and spring.
Hmm. Sujatha, you're one of those volunteers. How long have you been volunteering?
About 5 years now.
5 years. And you work with what age? Do you have an age? I mean, it's K-12. Do you specialize in a particular age level or what?
Mark, I really enjoy working with elementary level. So I make sure I mentioned to Chris that below fifth graders, I can handle, and I enjoy working with them. Hmm. So it's usually been only up to fifth grade.
And talk to us a little bit more about what makes that so rewarding. What do you like about working with elementary age kids?
Oh, it is the most gratifying thing to do, volunteering with the kids. My primary reason to even start this is my kids got this. When they were in school, they had Junior Achievement. They came home very excited about Junior Achievement. And so when an opportunity came up for me to be involved, it was me 100% involved. I've gone to Lansing schools and East Lansing, Okemos, and Hazlitt. And, of course, recently the one I just got done is St. Thomas. The little kids are, they just wait for your arrival. And, you know, it's just exciting to see them. And the first first, I mean, usually the last one I got done is first graders. So like five sessions, you walk in the first time, they don't know you, but they get to know you. And then second session you go, they're waving at the door. They're waiting for you to enter because I'm waiting there for my time to enter and there's already a session going on. And they just, the teacher can't wait to let me in to get going. So it's that exciting. And every story, every little thing, they remember it and they respond back to you. And it's gratifying.
What do you do to engage a first grader in learning about money and business?
Oh, it's very interesting. I know our topic for first graders was our families. And the information that JA gives you to get working on this is tremendously foolproof, dumbproof. You just have to spend 15 minutes to prepare for the class. And you walk in, and then there was the first time you talk about is you show a community, a big map of community, of parents helping or a person taking out garbage out or someone who goes to the school bus to get the kids out. And that is the first picture you show them. And then you talk about families. And the next session is you talk about need and want. And these are first graders, right? So this is Christmas time coming. And you really want to emphasize the difference between need and want. And they go from that. And I came up with a story of taking a trip to Mars. And if you have to take a trip with me to Mars, and so let's all do it. So we went with the kids to Mars. And the first grader said, okay, now let's see what we need. And so sure enough, at the end of the story, they figured out the only three things that we need is shelter, food, and clothes. And so we came back to Earth again. And then so next session I went in, and I had those little flashcards. They show, you know, for them to recognize what we did in the past. So there's this need, and there's this want. And then those kids are like, oh, like when we went to Mars the other day. It is so real. And, you know, when they associated that story so well and took a good lesson from that.
We're learning about junior achievement in Mid-Michigan with volunteer Sujatha Shankar, along with senior program manager Chris Hakor. Chris, why do you think economic and financial skills are important to learn at a young age?
Oh, I think it's huge. I think anytime we can teach a student at the 11th and 12th grade level to be able to talk about financial literacy, a bit about developing a budget and developing other things with them. But if we have found that we start them out in the kindergarten grade, and we work them all the way through first, second, third, all the way up through 12th grade, we found that it's just the repetitiveness in talking about these things, I think it's just gigantic. And we have found that to be true over the years. And so I think it's vitally important that we start early with the kids. And so that's why we are a K-12 program.
You started out as a volunteer as well, correct?
I did.
And now you're with the organization.
Absolutely, and I absolutely loved it when I did it. I mean, I can remember the first time I went in, where my kids go to Grand Ledge, and I went into Willow Ridge Elementary, and I told my wife, I said, this is going to be exciting. I went in there, taught the class, and when I came out of that classroom and I called my wife, I was literally shaking, quite honestly. It was so much fun, you know, and it's rewarding. You know, a lot of these kids, when I go into volunteer training or something of that sort, I tell them, I say, listen, sometimes what we need to do is we need to follow script, but the fact of the matter is you're going to find that what I need you to do is be happy, be alive, and be with these kids, because sometimes it's the most positive thing they see all day.
I'm curious if both of you were raised with an adequate degree of financial literacy education. Chris is shaking his head no. Sujatha, do you feel like you were? I mean,
yes.
I'm curious how you ended up this place. How did you end up in this place? I'm thinking it may have had something to do with your own financial literacy when you were young.
That's true. You know, I work for Jackson, and we talk money. We deal with money all the time. So I take my experience.
Jackson National.
I take my experience to the classroom. I tell them what I do when I first introduce myself. And it's important for them to understand, to stay in school, to survive, to go through everything they do every year, and to graduate. And that is the ultimate for your need and want. Ultimately, you need money to buy anything. And that money, you know, you have to have a good job to get the money. And we talk about businesses and entrepreneurs and how to start businesses. Everything turns around to say, you got to be successful in school to get there.
I was really quite surprised at the number of different programs that you offer when I visited your website. JA Be Entrepreneurial, JA Career Success, JA Global Marketplace. I counted 21 altogether with different emphases. Very impressive. Chris, how can listeners get involved and become volunteers?
Oh, absolutely. Mark, they can visit our website at www.jamidmichigan.org, but they can also reach out to me anytime, 24 hours a day. I'm always there. My phone number is 896-2002. They can also use chris.hucord, H-O-C-Q-U-A-R-D, at j.org. And, you know, anytime they want to talk, if they want to shadow someone that has actually done the program and is teaching in the classrooms, they can do that. I would love to go in the classroom. They can shadow me, and I can show them exactly how to do it before they have the opportunity to do it. So anything they need to do, I will do it.
You have a fundraiser or some kind of fundraising event coming up. Can you tell us about that?
I certainly can. I mean, that's it's a JA Star Makers event. It's on December 1st. It's at the Radisson Hotel. And basically what we do is it's a fundraiser. It's an ASK program. And basically what we have is we have a lot of kids from different school systems that will be there performing. And so it's great. It's entertaining. We provide a breakfast. And it's just a very fun time.
If we've got a listener right now who's thinking about maybe giving some thought to becoming a volunteer, how many hours a week does it require?
It's funny. There's got several different ways to get involved, but I will tell you that it's generally what we do is we say it's between 30 and 45 minutes a week for 5 weeks for the elementary programs. In middle school, it can be anywhere from 6 to 7 sessions, and at high school, it can be 5 to 7 sessions. And when I say a session, that's generally about 45 minutes. They usually go in traditional style. We'll do it for once a week for 5 weeks, or you get with the teacher, they get with you, you guys can make your own schedule. So it's very, very flexible.
JAMidMichigan.org.
Correct.
Good starting point right there, the website. We've been speaking with Junior Achievement of MidMichigan's Senior Program Manager Chris Hucor and Volunteer Sujatha Shankar. And to find out more about the program, JAMidMichigan.org. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you so much,
Mark. I appreciate the time.
Well, during tough times in your life, it's helpful to keep a little bit of silliness around to cheer you up, a visit to the Cat Cafe, whatever. This week's public poetry announcement is a good option. For that, here is MSU Center for Poetry Director Anita Skeen reading Frivolous by Irene McKinney.
I'm wearing pink socks and double ponytails sticking out of the sides of my head because, face it, I'm basically a creature of impulse who has opted for frivolity in the face of illness, and because I still can. I go on to make self-consciously exaggerated remarks that fool no one, and I decide that's fine. In infinite regress, I'll go on with the line as far as it takes me, and beyond, even to the place where I fall down on my final bed when the illness pulls me there, and in between defiant statements and tics of various entertaining kinds, slated to be remembered by my friends and family, I hope to look at the situation cleansed and purified by a lifetime of simply fooling around.
Frivolous by Irene McKinney is being read there by Anita Skeen. Our public poetry announcements are produced in partnership with the MSU Center for Poetry. Well, for several years now, MSU Culinary Services corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski has shown us some new ways to use traditional Thanksgiving ingredients. So if you're inclined to try something new this year, he's back. Current State Scott Pohl met up again with the chef for a new spin on a Thanksgiving tradition. What's Kurt up to this time, Scott?
Well, Mark, after finding new ways to use cranberry sauce and sweet potatoes in the past, Kurt Kwiatkowski turns his attention this year to what many of us consider to be a crucial part of the meal, the dressing. This is the way Kurt likes to make Thanksgiving dressing at home, and if you like turkey dressing as much as I do, you'll want to give this recipe a try.
I prefer to never put it in the bird, so I like cooking it in a pan. You can get everything done and rolling, and when you go to put it in the oven, It's 35, 40 minutes afterwards, and it comes out nice and crunchy on top and nice and soft and chewy in the inside. So it'll be delicious.
All right. What kind of bread are we going to use?
I prefer sourdough because, you know, again, we're talking about a dish that's going to have a heaviness to it, and trying to lighten that up a little bit with the flavor. So it's just not all heavy flavor on top of heavy flavor on top of heavy flavor. And that's why we're going to have some fun. And the sourdough, I think, cuts through a lot of that.
Will this recipe work with any bread, though?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you just happen to have a French batard or some extra hamburger buns laying around, you can easily use that as well.
A bit stale, is that better?
Stale is better, but it doesn't have to be. You can run out to the store and grab a couple of loaves and cut it up. And what you're going to want to do, if it isn't stale or hard already, what I'll do sometimes is have the kids start pulling the bread apart. So I'll cut it into some strips and then let them pull the pieces apart. And, you know, go ahead and put it in a bowl and put it in on a sheet tray. Drizzle a little bit of olive oil over it and then into the oven at like 250 degrees. And every maybe 15 minutes, just shake it a little bit. And after about 30 minutes, 40 minutes, that bread should be nice and crunchy and hard and ready to go. And then you just put it into a big mixing bowl, and then you start putting all the other ingredients together.
What are the other main ingredients we'll be working with?
Onions, celery, garlic, jalapeno, bacon. And I am I like sausage in my stuffing, so we've got some sweet Italian sausage and then some fresh herbs. We've got a little bit of cream and some chicken stock.
I see a couple of eggs over there too.
Oh, yep.
All right, let's get started. What's first?
So what we're going to do first is get our pan on about medium heat, and we've got the bacon, and we've kind of just cut it up into strips. And we're going to render that down. And we're going to put a couple tablespoons of olive oil in there to kind of help it along. And you don't want the heat to be too high because you don't want to burn your bacon.
I like this start, bacon.
Well, it's going to make your kitchen smell delicious too. So as that bacon's rendering, we can go ahead and chop up our vegetables. I like using red onion. Again, a little bit of a sweetness factor. I also like it because of the color variation that ends up going into the stuffing. We're gonna get about 2 cups of red onion diced up. And then we're gonna get about 2 cups of celery diced up. Got that, and then we're going to give our bacon a little bit of a stir. And it's already starting to kind of brown up just a little bit, which is what we want. And now for a little bit of a twist, we've got some jalapeno that we're going to add. And I take the seeds and the veins out, and that's where a lot of that heat is. So we got our jalapeno nice and diced up. And we've got our garlic. And we just mince that up. We get our big mixing bowl here. And what we're going to do is get the bacon out, but leave the bacon grease and the juices in. Because we still got some cooking to do. And so we still have that liquid in there, the oil in there. Now we've got our Italian sausage that we're gonna put in there. Kind of flatten it out.
Is there a substitute for the Italian sausage if you don't happen to have that?
You could just leave it out, I guess. You could always use a little bit of extra bacon. Madden, just a little bit of salt to that. This is where I'm going to turn the heat up a little bit. I want to get a nice golden brown, and that's why I want it as thin as possible in the pan, because the more surface area I can get browned up and caramelized up, the better the added flavor is going to be in the final product. That liquid is going to end up going into the stuffing to add extra flavor, and we're going to saute our vegetables kind of quickly in that, and it's just going to add flavor. And I've seen a lot of stuffing recipes before where you're adding like 4 and 5 cups of liquid to it, and it's like I'd rather add flavor instead of just stock and different things like that. And while that's going on, we can take our 2 eggs and we're going to crack those into another mixing bowl. And we're going to whisk that with 1/4 cup of cream. And this is our main liquid that we're going to add to our stuffing. And after we've mixed that egg and the cream together, we're going to take 2 cups of chicken stock, and that's ready to go. And into the pan go the onions and the celery and the jalapeno. And we turn that heat back down just a little bit, kind of medium, medium high. And we don't need to cook these all the way through, we just need to kind of start to sweat them. And while those are sauteing, we're going to get our fresh herbs ready to go. And we've got parsley, where we're going to get about 1/2 cup of parsley. And we're just going to chop that up. And whenever we're cooking with fresh herbs, we always add them in at the end of anything we're doing. And so since we're going to be baking, we're going to fold those in right before it goes into the oven. I use just like 1 tablespoon of fresh sage, just that little bit, just to kind of get that hint for the fresh herbs. And we're just gonna pick some fresh thyme. And now for those last minute or so, I'm gonna hit the fresh garlic in there. I don't wanna add the garlic too soon because I don't wanna burn it. And I just stir that around and let that the bouquet of that garlic smell kind of start to come out.
It smells great, Kurt.
Yeah, this is really making me hungry. The celery's still going to be kind of hard, but you know, we're going to bake it for a good 40 minutes, and so in goes our mixture. And now we've got our fresh herbs and our liquid. And what I like doing with the sausage is kind of just taking I like trying to break it up with a spatula. You can kind of cut it up with a knife as well. We've got our liquid. We're gonna pour over everything. I like hitting it with a little salt and pepper. And we've got our fresh herbs that are gonna go in there. And we just mix away. Oven can be, you know, wherever you got your turkey at. If it's at 325, put it in at 325. If you're cooking your bird at 350, that's fine. I like it covered for the first 20 minutes and then uncovered the last 20 minutes. Make sure you're not filling the pan up too much because that bread's still going to absorb just a little bit and it's going to expand a little bit. Hopefully what's happened with the way the bread is too, that sourdough and that we've cooked it, you still got a little bit of a textural crunch to it. Oh, and then you're good to go.
Now this will bake for how long?
40 minutes.
How many will this recipe serve?
Oh, this will easily serve. Well, it depends upon how hungry you are, but this recipe would easily serve, you know, 6-8 people.
We're going to give it a go here. This will be the uncooked taste test, right?
Yeah. Give her a taste if you want.
All right. I need to get some sausage in with it.
That's a good
bread
call.
And sausage. Okay, here we go. Mmm. I'm not sure I've ever had dressing with sausage in it. That's delicious. Kurt Kwiatkowski is a corporate chef at Michigan State University. We will be posting this recipe and a series of photos at WKAR.org. Always great to see you. Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving, Kurt.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It's always good to see you as well, and have a great holiday.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Looking ahead to Monday, which seems so wonderfully far away, we talk with sociologist Cheryl Neely, whose recent book, You're Dead, So What?, looks at the way media and law enforcement treat black female murder victims. Also, we'll be back with a review of Michigan's biggest political stories for the month of November. MERS News' Kyle Malin and MLive's Emily Lawler join me. That and more Monday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our program today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Get the latest Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get fine podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, maybe throw some stars our way. We hope you enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR.